This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll get to Terry's interview with Quentin Tarantino. But first, David Bianculli has a review of the PBS masterpiece classic series Downton Abbey. The British period drama that's taken England and America by storm is beginning its third season.
Downton Abbey, the drama series about the residents and servants at a grand estate in early 20th century England, has done for PBS what the commercial broadcast networks couldn't achieve last year. It generated a hit show, one whose audience increased over its run and left its fans hungry for more. And that's a lot of hunger, because when season 2 was televised here in the States on PBS, it averaged 7 million viewers, more than most TV shows on any network, cable or broadcast. In fact, it's the largest audience in the history of Masterpiece, a PBS franchise that goes back more than 40 years. And the secret to the success of Downton Abbey can be found in the early history of Masterpiece Theatre. In 1974, Masterpiece Theatre imported the first installment of Upstairs Downstairs, which caught on in America just as Downton has now, and with a very similar story. That miniseries showed life in a proper upper-class British household from the points of view of both the ruling class, the upstairs, and the servant class, the downstairs. Back then, in an era before videocassette recorders, fans held upstairs-downstairs viewing parties and waited impatiently for each installment. With Downton, fans in the U.S. either caught it on PBS or gobbled it up afterward on DVD or downloaded it. But the effect is the same, and so is the quality. Julian Fellowes, the creator and writer of Downton Abbey, has done a great job making a very compelling period soap opera. Season 3 is his best work yet. The first two seasons spent a lot of time dealing with world events outside the household, from the sinking of the Titanic to World War I. Season 3, set at the start of the 1920s, focuses almost exclusively on events within the Downton estate itself. And as far as plots and intrigue go, that's plenty. As the season begins, one storyline concerns the post-war economy and how Robert Crawley, who owns the estate, may have to sell it. Out of desperation, Cora, his American wife, sends for her wealthy mother to visit, in hopes that the Crawley women can persuade her to finance their lavish lifestyle. The mother, Martha, is played by new cast member Shirley MacLaine, who's excellent. She doesn't steal the show. She can't. Not with Maggie Smith already dominating every scene she's in as Cora's mother-in-law, the acerbic, sarcastic Dowager Countess. But MacLaine fits in perfectly. Here's a scene in which the Dowager Countess comments about Cora's brother when what she really wants to do is charm Martha into sharing her fortune. But for the Dowager Countess, charm doesn't come easily. During this conversation, you'll also hear Elizabeth McGovern as Cora and Michelle Dockery as Lady Mary, one of the three Crowley daughters.
It always seems so strange to me that Cora has a brother.
Why?
You know how things work here, Mother. If there's a boy, the daughters don't get anything.
There's no such thing as an English heiress with a brother. Why do we never see him?
Oh, Harold hates to leave America.
Curious. He hates to leave America. I should hate to go there.
You don't mean that, Granny, when we're both so drawn to America.
Indeed, indeed, we are. Never more than now, when the bond between the Crawleys and the Levinsons is so strong.
That's nice. If you mean it, Ma.
I do. It is marvellous the way our families support each other.
You mean you needed the Levinson cash to keep the Crawleys on top?
I'm not sure we'd put it that way.
I'm quite sure we would not.
But I hope you do feel that Mama's fortune has been well spent in shoring up an ancient family.
Now you gotta spend it on something.
That scene, like most scenes in Downton Abbey, has two layers. There's the veneer of the social graces, the ritualistic politeness of it all. And, beneath that shiny surface, there's what's really going on. The desperation, the intrigue, the jealousies and obsessions and secrets. Every character in Downton Abbey, from the lowliest cook's maid to the earl of the estate, is a delight to spend time with. And even the occasional exterior shots of the estate itself are breathtakingly beautiful, whether shown in bright sunlight, moody moonlight, or misty rain. The building is so gorgeous, inside and out, It's understandable why those who live and work there want to cling to it, whatever their station. And for Downton Abbey, the TV series, the station in America is PBS. While American cable TV gives us the Kardashians and Honey Boo Boo as royalty, Masterpiece Classic has generated a hit by treating us to a touch of class. And to Shirley MacLaine as Martha, leading her stuffy British in-laws in an impromptu sing-along.
Let me
David Biancooley is founder and editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches TV and film history at Rowan University. Downton Abbey is beginning its third season. On Monday's Fresh Air, I'll speak with Downton Abbey's creator and writer, Julian Fellows. If you missed that interview, just look for it on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. Quentin Tarantino wrote and directed the films Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown, and Inglourious Basterds. His latest film, Django Unchained, hit theaters on Christmas Day. Django Unchained pays tribute to spaghetti westerns and is set in the American South just a couple of years before the Civil War. Christoph Waltz, who played the Nazi known as the Jew Hunter in Inglourious Basterds, plays King Schultz, a dentist-turned-bounty hunter who frees a slave who can help him identify three white men he's tracking down. That slave, Django, is played by Jamie Foxx. Schultz and Django become partners and go in search of Django's wife, who was sold to another plantation after she and Django had tried to escape. They soon figure out she's now a slave on the plantation owned by Calvin Candy, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. To get access to the plantation, Django and Schultz pretend they want to purchase Candy's top Mandingo fighters. Mandingos are slaves who battle each other to the death for the entertainment of white people. Before we get to Terry's interview with Tarantino, let's listen to a clip from Django Unchained. This is the scene where Schultz and Django first meet Leonardo DiCaprio's character Candy, who speaks first.
What's your name, boy?
His name is Django Freeman.
Why'd you dig him up?
Well, a fortuitous turn of events brought Django and myself together.
I've heard tell about you. I heard you've been telling everybody that Mandingos ain't no damn good. Ain't nothing nobody is selling is worth buying. I'm curious. What makes you such a Mandingo expert?
I'm curious what makes you so curious.
What did you say, boy?
Calm down, Butch. No offense given. None taken.
Monsieur Condi, I'd appreciate if you could direct your line of inquiry toward me.
One, you do not have anything to drink. Can I get you a tasty refreshment?
Yes, I'll have a beer.
Wunderbar. Roscoe, a beer for the man with the beard, and I will have a Polynesian pearl diver. Do not spare the rum.
Quentin Tarantino, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you. So the film is called Django Unchained, and Jamie Foxx plays Django. And the name Django comes from a series of spaghetti westerns in which the main character, I suppose, is called Django.
It's kind of an interesting history about those movies is after the Dollars trilogies came out and kind of created this entire new genre in Italy.
This is for a fist full of dollars, for a few dollars more. The Clint Eastwood,
and Good,
Sergio
the Bad, and the Ugly.
Good, Bad, and the Ugly. The Sergio Leone, Clint Eastwood movies.
Exactly. After that, made a cottage industry out of Rome and Almeria, Spain. Sergio Corbucci did his film Django, starring Franco Nero, in 1966, and it became a smash all throughout Europe and in particularly Asia and Latin America. And didn't play that well. It didn't play that much in America, and was actually banned until the 90s in England because it's so violent. In fact, it's actually kind of an interesting story. You couldn't see Django ever in England. The closest you could ever come to see Django in England was in the movie The Harder They Come with Jimmy Cliff. When Jimmy Cliff's on the run, he actually goes to a theater and watches Django.
Really? I saw that film so long ago, I never would have remembered that. Wow.
Yeah, the couple of scenes that you see of Django in The Harder They Come is the closest that Django ever got to playing in England. But the thing is, the movie, you know, it kicked up the violence and the surrealism and the brutality of spaghetti westerns to a new level. And it became so popular that there really only was one kind of genuine official sequel. It had Terrence Hill playing the character, and Franco Rosati, one of the screenwriters, wrote that script. And you could tell it's obviously supposed to be the same guy, except maybe a little earlier. But all the other Django, there's about 40 of them. It's not the same character. They just call them Django just because the name became so popular.
So in your Django movie, Django Unchained, Jamie Foxx is a slave who is freed during the course of the movie, and his name mm-hmm. is Django. And the kind of catchphrase, the trademark phrase from the movie, somebody asks him in his name, and he says, "Django, the D is silent."
Right.
That's great. So can you talk a little bit about coming up with that line? I doubt that line is in the original Django.
No, it's not. It was actually simply the fact that it seems like I thought everyone would know how to say the name Django, all right? You know, even if it wasn't from the spaghetti westerns, at least from Django Reinhardt, you would know how to say it. And people would read the script, "Oh, the Django Unchained." Okay. And people would say it all the time. And frankly, I consider it an intelligence test. If you say the Django, you're definitely going down in my book. But where that actually came from was I came up with a cool bit, because actually Franco Nero's in the movie, and it's a sequence where we actually have the two Djangos in the same frame, both Jamie Foxx and Franco Nero. And so I have Franco look him up and down, ask him his name. Jamie says, "Django, can you spell it?" And then he spells the whole thing. And then after he gets through spelling it, I go, I had him say, "The D is silent." And then Nero looks at him and says, "I know." A little meta movie moment.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Quentin Tarantino, and we're talking about his new movie, Django Unchained. So there's a lot of violence in your movie. Slaves are being whipped and tortured, slaves forced to fight to the death like gladiators, lots of shooting and splatter. So what are your – how do I put this exactly? What are your limits for – like what's your – sensibility for how much splatter, how much violence, how much sadism? It feels like right, like it's part of the genre, like there's a certain like style to it that you're trying to express. And what's going to the point of like past where you want to go, to the point of like revulsion and exploitation to to a degree that's just, I don't want to use the word immoral, but just, you know, bad.
Well, frankly, I mean, you know, what happened during slavery times is 1,000 times worse than I show. So if I were to show it 1,000 times worse, to me, that wouldn't be exploitive. That would just be how it is. If you can't take it, you can't take it. Now, I wasn't trying to do a Schindler's List, "You are there under the barbed wire of Auschwitz" kind of movie. I wanted the film to be more entertaining than that. But there's two types of violences in this film. There's the brutal reality of the violence that that slaves lived under the slavery laws for 245 years. And then there's the violence of Django's retribution. And that's movie violence. And that's fun, and that's cool, and that's really enjoyable. It's kind of what you're waiting for, and it's actually paying back the pain that you had to watch to get there. And so there are two different type of aesthetics going on, and I wanted the painful violence of the slavery sections to hurt and to be painful. Now, here's the deal. I could handle a lot more than I put in this movie. I have a tolerance for viscera more than the average person. So I could have actually handled it a lot more. And like as I was cutting the movie, earlier versions of it had more in there. But when I started watching it with when I started showing it in front of audiences, I have a lot of different emotions I want you to kind of get to in the course of this movie. And one of the emotions I want you to get to at the end is cheering Django. I want you to cheer his triumphs at the end and you know, be rooting for him and actually cheer. And if you don't cheer at the end, I haven't done the job. I haven't pulled off the movie I was trying to pull off. I mean, it's very easy for me if I've failed or succeeded. If the audience cheers at the end, I've succeeded. If they don't cheer or if it's a qualified cheer, maybe I haven't failed, but it was a qualified response, and this house didn't go with it as much as I thought they should have. As much as they were supposed to. So it's a very clear choice of, you know, did I do it, did I not do it? And when I watched it with, you know, those rougher scenes like the Mandingo scene or the dog scene or the castration scene, when they were rougher, I traumatized the audience too much. They were too traumatized. So the responses in all the other sections of the film were qualified by that trauma.
Well, I think when you're watching the film, the audience isn't thinking like you're thinking, because you're thinking like there's the reality violence and then there's the fun genre violence.
Oh, I think they are. I think they are. Yeah? I totally think they are. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally think they are. One, there's the violence that's hard to watch and there's the violence that's fun to watch. I think they're totally thinking that.
There's a part of the Western genre and the spaghetti Western genre that's about sadism, you know, where, and a line from your film that I'm thinking of and is like, no, don't shoot them. It's too simple for these men. So yeah. The implication is not shooting them. It's an easy death. You got to torture them first.
Yeah,
and I grew up on so many Westerns where that was just like a part of it. And of course, two things happen. First, there's the opportunity for some torture. And in a lot of Westerns, that's very lightweight, like not allowing them to drink in the desert or something. And others, it's much more rougher stuff. But then there's also the opportunity for escape because you're not killing them. So that gives them time to get free.
Well, there actually is this, you know, thing in spaghetti Westerns. It's almost a ritual trial by fire that usually happens to the spaghetti Western hero. At some point, he's captured by the villains.
Right.
And he's given a Passion of Christ beating at the hands of the bad guys. And then he gets away and rains down vengeance on them. It's kind of part and parcel to the spaghetti Western. You even call it a spaghetti Western beating.
And what do you like about that?
What do I like about it?
Mm-hmm.
That's fun.
So I just have to ask you, is it any less fun after, like, the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary? Like, do you ever go through a period where you lose your taste for movie violence? And movie violence is not real violence. I understand the difference. But still, are there times when it just is not a fun movie experience for you, either to be making it that way or to be in the audience for something like that?
Not for me.
So it's so completely separate that the reality of violence doesn't affect at all your feelings about making or viewing very violent or sadistic.
Sadistic? I don't know. You're putting a judgment on it.
No. The characters are sadistic. The characters are sadistic. I'm not talking about, you know, the filmmaker. I'm talking about the characters. I mean, the characters are undeniably sadistic.
Yeah. When you say after the tragedy, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well,
do you mean on that day would I watch The Wild Bunch? Maybe not on that day.
Or in the next few days. Like, while it's still while it's still really fresh in your reality.
Would I watch a kung fu movie 3 days after the Sandy Hook massacre? Would I watch a kung fu movie? Maybe, because they have nothing to do with each other.
You sound annoyed that I'm...
Yeah.
I know you've been asked this a lot.
Yeah, I'm really annoyed. I think it's disrespectful. I think it's disrespectful to their memory, actually.
Which, whose memory?
The memory of the people who died, to talk about movies. I think it's totally disrespectful to their memory. Obviously, the issue is gun control and mental health.
Just one other related question. Did you ever, because I know you really enjoy, have always enjoyed really violent movies, have you ever been exposed to a movie image, even when you were a child or as an adult, that you wished you hadn't seen because it was so troubling and scary and you had nightmares about it and haunted you?
Well, you make that's not supposed to happen. Like, that would be a bad thing.
Not passing value judgment, just asking.
Yeah, well, let me just say this. It's,
I mean, what some of my favorite movies from childhood, like, terrified me, but...
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, I mean, here's just kind of where I'm coming from, is I've been asked this question for 20 years.
Which question?
About the effects of violence in movies relating to violence in real life. And my answer is the same 20 years ago. It hasn't changed one iota.
And it's the answer you just gave?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I don't know what I just said, but obviously I don't agree. I don't think one has to do with the other.
Right. So this question is kind of separate from all of that. The question about images that haunted you. So let's define this as a different chapter. But I'll give you a for instance. When I was growing up in New York, the first time the Charles Laughton version of The Hunchback of Notre Dame came on Million Dollar Movie, I was absolutely terrified. I forced my family to change the channel and put on Texas Rangers because just the sight of Charles Laughton's face was so horrifying to me, because he has a very, disfigured face in the film. And it's set in, like, medieval times, and the whole thing just terrified me. And then the movie, it was a Million Dollar Movie, so it was repeated like several times every day for a week. And I found like I had to keep putting on the TV, and every day I'd watch more of it. And to this day, it is one of my favorite movies. I mean, I think it is just an absolutely beautiful film in every way. But it started off as being terrifying for me and filled with images that scared me. So I'm just wondering about the correlation in your mind between images that you found frightening and movies you ended up liking, or images that maybe you wished you'd never seen.
The only thing that I've ever watched in a movie that I wished I'd never seen is real-life animal death, or real-life insect death in a movie. That's absolutely positively where I draw the line. And a lot of European and Asian movies do that. And we even did that in America for a little bit of time. I don't like seeing horses being yanked on cables from running W's. I don't like seeing animals murdered on screen. Movies are about make-believe. It's about imagination. Part of the thing is we're trying to create a realistic experience, but we are faking it. And it's the faking it is the art. The faking it is the... it's the art of it. It's the make-believe of it all. I don't think that there's any place in a movie for real death. And you can say, Peckinpah shot the heads off the chickens in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, but it's okay because they ate the chickens afterwards. And actually, maybe those chickens got 3 more days of life because they were taken out of a slaughterhouse and everything. Well, you can justify it in that way because people eat chicken and I eat chicken, so all good. I don't want to see real death, though. That's the problem. It's the watching of the real chicken get his real head blown off. I don't pay money, or I don't want to sit down and watch real death when I watch a movie. I don't even want to see an animal terrified. I've seen movies where they've terrified an animal to get a response from him, and I don't want to see that.
You want to see artifice. You don't want to see genuine pain.
Yes, it's
make-believe. Or torture or death.
Exactly. It's make-believe.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Quentin Tarantino. We're talking about the new movie that he wrote and directed, Django Unchained. Here's something I was wondering. I know there's so much, African-American popular culture that you really love. And I was wondering, when you were growing up, if you grew up in an integrated neighborhood, if you went to an integrated school, if you had African-American friends, or if your contact with black people was largely through popular culture.
No, I went to a mostly black school. It wasn't all black because I was there, but it was mostly black. And at different points in my life, I was raised by black people, raised in black homes, between my mom's best friend that I lived a lot of times with her and her family, and just the kind of United Nations aspect that my mom's house was in the early 70s, right at the explosion of black culture. So black culture is my culture growing up.
Your mother had a United Nations kind of home?
Yeah. Well, it was almost like a sitcom, actually, the way we lived in the 70s, because she was in her 20s. She was hot, all right, and she was a hot white girl. Her best friend was named Jackie. She was a hot black girl, and her other best friend was Lillian, and she was a hot Mexican girl. And they lived in this, like, swinging singles apartment with me.
What impact did that have on you?
Yeah, well, it was in the 70s. So it was, I lived with these three hip ladies all going out on dates all the time and dating football players and basketball players. And,
professional ones?
No, my mom dated Wilt Chamberlain. She's one of the thousand.
Rich, she
one
of Did that, this is getting too personal, but did that affect your sense of sexuality when you were growing up?
In what way?
Well, because most people can't imagine their parents having sex. And when you're growing up with, like, your mother and two other women who are obviously engaging, it makes you think of your...
Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. It was just, she was a woman. She was living the life. She was having a good time and everything, She was taking care of me, too. So everything was fine. It was hip. It was just cool. The boyfriends had come over and they'd take me to blaxploitation movies, trying to, get me to like them and buy me footballs and stuff. And we'd go to, like, cool, my mom and her friends would take me to cool bars and stuff where they'd be playing cool live rhythm and blues music. And I'd be drinking, Shirley Temple's, I think I called them James Bond because I didn't like the name Shirley Temple. I drank Shirley Temple's and eat Mexican food or whatever, while it's like some Jimmy Soul and a cool band would be playing in some lava loungy kind of a 70s cocktail lounge. It was really cool. It made me grow up in a real big way. I was when I would hang around with kids, I'd think they were really childish. I was used to hanging around with, like, really groovy adults.
So one last question, because I know you have to go. I know you bought a movie theater in L.A. What's your dream movie theater? Like, if you could design a movie theater from scratch, what would it be?
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I'd really want to spend the money to build.
You don't have to spend the money. It's a dream movie theater. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, but I would be more inclined to actually take over some cool, more historical theater or something like that. I mean, I guess a dream movie theater for me would be if I owned the Castro. In San Francisco. That would be awesome.
It's
own the Castro
organ
would be cool.
In there, and yeah.
Oh, yeah. That would be awesome.
Okay.
I guess maybe the Cinerama Dome, too, all right, if we're going to really dream.
And what's your own movie theater like?
Oh, it's a little shoebox.
Oh, okay.
I'd like to do so much stuff there, but I can't because it's just so small. All right, but it's lovely in its tackiness. But it's genuine. It's a single, really nice and cute and modest, and always shows 35mm. Except right now, oddly enough, because they're playing Django, the original Django, and they only have a digital thing, and they actually had to ask my permission to show something digital there, and I
and you gave
broke
it.
Down. I broke down and gave it on this one instance.
You've
this
compromised.
One alone. This one instance and this one instance alone.
Quentin Tarantino wrote and directed the new film Django Unchained. You'll find a longer version of his interview with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Coming up, we'll hear from the star of Django Unchained, Christoph Waltz. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
I'm a detective. A damn good detective. Finding people is my specialty, so naturally I worked for the Nazis finding people, and yes, some of them were Jews, but Jew Hunter? Just a name that stuck.
That's our guest Christoph Waltz playing the Nazi Colonel Hans Landa in Quentin Tarantino's film Inglourious Basterds. Before that film, Americans had never heard of Waltz. But he managed to win just about every major award for his performance in that film, including an Oscar and a Golden Globe. Waltz is Austrian and had been in European movies, TV shows, and theater. Since teaming up with Tarantino, he's been in the films Carnage, Water for Elephants, and The Green Hornet. Now he stars in Tarantino's new film, Django Unchained. Waltz plays Dr. King Schultz, a dentist-turned-bounty hunter who frees a slave named Django, played by Jamie Foxx. Django helps Schultz track down slave owners with bounties on their heads. The two become partners and go searching for Django's wife, who was brutally beaten and sold to a different plantation. Before we get to Terry's interview with Christoph Waltz, let's listen to a clip from Django Unchained. In this scene, Schultz has just told Django that he thinks Django's wife is now a slave owned by the brutal Calvin Candy, whose plantation they just visited on false pretenses.
Sure, sir. He didn't call her by name, but she's a young lady, whip marks on her back, and speaks German. Now, while it's not wise to assume in this instance, I think it's pretty safe. Point being, don't get so carried away with your retribution. You lose sight of why we're here.
You think I lost sight of that?
Yes, I do. Stop antagonizing Candy.
I'm not antagonizing. I'm intriguing him.
You're yelling abuse at these poor slaves?
I recall a man who had me kill another man in front of his son, and he didn't bat an eye. You remember that?
Yeah, of course I remember.
What you said was that this is my world. In my world, you gotta get dirty. So that's what I'm doing. I'm getting dirty.
Christoph Waltz, welcome to Fresh Air. In Django Unchained, you're a German bounty hunter in the South 2 years before the Civil War. And Jamie Foxx is a slave who you have managed to free, and you enlist him to help you track down plantation hunters who you will get a bounty for, because he'll be able to recognize them and you don't know who they are. And
right.
He tells you that he wants to find his wife, who was sold to a different plantation, so they were separated. And her name is Broomhilda, and you explain to him, you suggest, well, maybe she's German. She must be German because that's such a part of German lore. And, of course, most of us know Brunhilde as, you know, inspired by that lore from Wagner's Ring Cycle, you know, the opera. Now, I know, mm-hmm. I know mm-hmm. you studied opera. Do I have it right?
Well, yeah, it is and it isn't. I studied voice and singing for a while, parallel to drama school. And then they said, in both departments, they said, well, you have to make a choice. And my voice was good enough to get through the audition and into the academy in Vienna, but I'm not so sure whether it would have been good enough for an opera career. There are remnants of that in the form of like a desperate desire to come into contact with music one way or another. But I still think it was the right choice. But we went to the opera together. I thought he would like it because I find his stories and his movies operatic. They are huge filmic operas. And if you watch them from that perspective, you gain even more joy and entertainment. They are operas without singing. So we went and they put the Ring Cycle at the LA Opera, the full cycle, which is, you know, not that often. It happens that they play all four operas back to back. And we went.
So in Django Unchained, you have to do some horse riding, and you're on a coach because you're a dentist turned bounty hunter. So was this the first time you were on a horse?
No. No, the first time I've been on a horse is probably 40 years ago. But I never really rode constantly. Writing is something that, in order to master it, you have to do it like playing an instrument, a musical instrument. You have to do it every day, and you have to do it over a long period of time. So I do, you know, the occasional bit, and when I need it for a movie, I start training again. But, you know, I kind of knew what I was doing, yeah. But shooting guns was something that I had absolutely no idea about it, nor any interest, I might add, because firearms are scary, and I have a, you know, I'm afraid of firearms. It's quite simple. So I hired an armorer to show me how it is to shoot a real gun. And the idea that if I do a wrong move out of incompetence and ignorance, somebody might die, greatly disturbed me.
You were in an accident, I think, riding.
Mm-hmm. And, and it was pretty nasty, yeah.
You had dislocated a pelvic bone, so...
No, I didn't dislocate anything. I broke it right through.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah.
So at that point, do you ask yourself, is the movie worth it?
You know, I'm not superstitious. We always try to find causality where there is just coincidence, and it's a mistake. Is the movie worth it? I don't know. It's not the price for the movie. It's not the tender for the movie. It happened on a movie, but it could have happened in a car, and it could have happened anywhere. It was actually a long time before we started shooting. I came here to train and practice and blah, 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 and it happened very early on. I think it was the third day of my training, and so we had to pause, and I had to get surgery and all that.
Is this part of the reason why your character spends so much time in a coach as opposed to a horse-drawn coach as opposed to on horseback?
Yeah, I'm afraid it is.
Oh, clever.
Because I couldn't get on a horse for 3 months.
Wow. Well, what a smart...
Well, it's Quentin.
Yeah, and Quentin makes the most of it. Because
Quentin says, you know, Quentin says, I remember Quentin's eyes when he came to the hospital to visit me. And I said, oh, I don't know what we're going to do. I can't ride for 3 months. And he looked at me and he said, you know, if you don't talk too much about it, I might get some interesting ideas. And he did.
Because the way a character is written now, you are a dentist turned bounty hunter, and you're driving around in your dentist horse-drawn coach with a big tooth, a big sculpture of a tooth on
right.
top.
Yeah, the bouncing tooth. No, it always was a dentist. It has nothing to do with the dentistry. No, but it really, then in the West, dentists were, how else would they have gotten around? They had a bag of tools, and the tools were nothing like dentists' tools. They were more like blacksmith's tools.
Yeah.
And they had a bag of that on the horse, and that's how they went from town to town. And all they did was extracting teeth.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Christoph Waltz, and he stars in Quentin Tarantino's new movie Django Unchained. And, of course, he was Colonel Landa, the Jew hunter, in Inglourious Basterds. So your first movie with Quentin Tarantino was Inglourious Basterds, and you won just about every award for it, including an Oscar and an award at the Cannes Film Festival. And with your permission, I'd like to play a scene from it.
Oh, thank you.
You play a Nazi named Colonel Hans Landa, and the opening scene is remarkable. It is an homage to spaghetti westerns in the way that it is shot, and it's like a Sergio Leone western. And so it opens during the German occupation of France in World War II. A French dairy farmer who lives in a kind of remote part of the French countryside with his three daughters sees you from a distance. Your car is coming closer, and we see the fear register on his face, and we all know no good is going to come out of this visit. So you get there, you kind of ingratiate yourself. He's forced to invite you in. You sit at his table. He's a dairy farmer. You ask for a glass of his milk, and as you're drinking it and telling him how delicious it is, you open your leather portfolio, and you're very... very orderly, kind of fastidious, and you take out some papers and arrange them on the table, take out your little bottle of ink, open up the lid, fill the fountain pen, very neatly put it down, and screw on the lid with this flourish of your hand. Then you explain to him why you're called the Jew Hunter and that it's your job to track down the remaining Jews hiding in the French countryside. And as you speak, the camera goes beneath the floor of the farmhouse, and we see several Jews are hiding beneath the floorboards, terrified. So here's some of the dialogue in which you're explaining to this French dairy farmer that it's your job to find the Jews, that you're there to hunt for the Jews, and that you know how to do it. You're good at what you do.
The feature that makes me such an effective hunter of the Jews is, as opposed to most German soldiers, I can think like a Jew, where they can only think like a German. More precisely, a German soldier. Now, if one were to determine what attribute the German people share with a beast, it would be the cunning and the predatory instinct of a hawk. But if one were to determine what attributes the Jews share with a beast, it would be that of the rat. The Führer and Goebbels' propaganda have said pretty much the same thing. But where our conclusions differ is I don't consider the comparison an insult. Consider for a moment the world a rat lives in. It's a hostile world, indeed. If a rat were to scamper through your front door right now, would you greet it with hostility?
I suppose I would.
Has a rat ever done anything to you to create this animosity you feel toward them?
Rats spread diseases. They bite people.
Rats were the cause of the bubonic plague, but that's some time ago. I propose to you any disease a rat could spread, a squirrel could equally carry. Would you agree?
Right.
Yet I assume you don't share the same animosity with squirrels that you do with rats, do you?
No.
Yet they're both rodents, are they not? And except for the tail, they even rather look alike, don't they?
It's an interesting thought, Herr Colonel.
However interesting as the thought may be, it makes not one bit of difference to how you feel. If a rat were to walk in here right now as I'm talking, would you greet it with a saucer of your delicious milk?
Probably not.
I didn't think so. You don't like them. You don't really know why you don't like them. All you know is you find them repulsive. Consequently, a German soldier conducts a search of a house suspected of hiding Jews. Where does the hawk look? He looks in the barn, he looks in the attic, he looks in a cellar, he looks everywhere he would hide. But there's so many places it would never occur to a hawk to hide. However, the reason the Führer's brought me off my Alps in Austria and placed me in French cow country today is because it does occur to me. Because I'm aware of what tremendous feats human beings are capable of once they abandon dignity.
Well, that's my guest, Christoph Waltz, in a scene from Inglourious Basterds. The writing in that and your performance in it are so extraordinary, and I love the logic in which you're explaining.
Thank you.
You know, you're explaining how logical it is to hunt the Jews.
All it requires is a shift of perspective, and it becomes scaringly logical. I loved your description of it. It was like a little play in itself. Thank you very much.
I was wondering if there are stage directions, you know, or whether it was just your idea to do. You're obviously like so neat, and you're so enjoying like filling the pen and laying everything out, because this is such a rational world you're inhabiting, you know. Like,
well,
of course, we're hunting the Jews. Of course, I love my ink and what delicious milk.
You know, I'm afraid that's what made those Nazis really, really terrifying, their efficiency and their technocratic and bureaucratic thoroughness, and everything is correct. As I said, all it takes is a step across the line and the reassurance
that you're on the right side. And that's something that needs to be considered, not just in historical hindsight, but even more importantly for our lives today.
When I interviewed Quentin Tarantino about Inglourious Basterds in 2009, he said he was having a lot of trouble finding an actor to play the role that you ended up playing. It was hard to find an actor who could speak German, French, and English fluently, and on top of that, who knew how to deliver Tarantino-style dialogue. And I want to play what he said about the difficulty of finding someone and then the joy of finding you. So here's Quentin Tarantino, recorded on Fresh Air in 2009.
I was having a problem with them doing my dialogue in English, and it wasn't a matter of fluency. You know, a lot of them could come in and we could speak for the next 9 hours in English and there would be no problem. English wasn't the language for them to read poetry in. And there's a poetic quality to my dialogue. I mean, there's an aspect I've always said that it's not poetry, but it's kind of like it. It's not song lyrics, but it's kind of like song lyrics. It's not rap, but it's kind of like rap. And it's not stand-up comedy, but it is kind of like stand-up comedy. It's all those things together. And there's wordplay, and there's rhythms, and you have to be able to get the poetry out of it. You have to be able to sell my jokes. And when it came to a lot of these German actors with the English, they just couldn't do it. They couldn't get the poetry out of it. They couldn't own it and make it their own. And then Christoph came in, and I didn't know who Christoph was. He's a TV actor in Germany. He came in, and I can literally say, halfway through the reading of that first scene in the farmhouse, I knew I'd found my Londa.
Quentin Tarantino, recorded in 2009. So, Christoph Waltz, obviously Tarantino was mighty impressed by the time you were halfway done with the audition scene, and I believe the audition scene was the scene we just heard.
Yeah. We then went on throughout the whole role. He read all the other parts. It was partly hilarious, partly just fabulous, partly scary. And we arrived at the end, and then we parted. And I said to the casting director, if this should have been it, it was definitely worth it. Well, then they called me back.
Christoph Waltz is nominated for a Golden Globe for his performance in Quentin Tarantino's new film Django Unchained. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org.
Django! Django, have you always been alone?
Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our associate producer for online media is Nell Beschenstein. Dorothy Ferby is our administrative assistant. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.